Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, if you've ever felt like a round peg in a square hole, or a square peg in a round hole, however you prefer to say it, stay tuned, because my first guest knows exactly what that feels like. I must admit I do too. And he became very aware of it after a boss told him many years ago that he was wearing a career-limiting tie. David Coulter will tell you, David Cooper will tell you how to capitalize on your uniqueness without compromising who you are. And coming up around 12:40, we'll talk with Peter Miller. He's the senior editor at National Geographic, and he's spent many years investigating how the collective intelligence of swarms, flocks, herds, and schools can help us become better communicators, can help us become better decision makers, and help us get more things done. Now, if you're raising your eyebrows at that, let me raise them some more, because the CIA used termites to create more effective spy networks. And Southwest Airlines used ants to figure out the most efficient way to board a plane. So next time you're standing in one of those long lines getting onto a plane and feeling as though you're being herded like a swarm of ants, you're not so far wrong. First, I'd like to welcome David Cooper to the show. David says that his mission in life is to educate and entertain. He's the author of 7 books and an award-winning career trainer and coach in the US, Europe, and Asia. He's helped outsiders become happy and successful, insiders at Fortune 100 companies, fast food joints, and faith-based organizations. He has a BA in communication. He completed a postgraduate diploma in education and graduated with a master's in spiritual psychology. He's also a member of the American Society of Training and Development and Society of Human Resources Professionals. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vicki.
And you say your name Cooper, right, David Cooper?
I do, yes, indeed.
Because it's spelt a little differently. It's C-O-U-P-E-R. But you've written this great book, David. It's called Outsiders on the Inside, How to Create a Winning Career Even When You Don't Fit In. And I mentioned that your mission in life is to educate and entertain, and that was the mission for your book, too. As someone who says that he's felt like an outsider all of his life, go back a few years, if you would, maybe to that career limiting tie moment, and tell us how you evolved your mission, how you evolved your career to doing what you're doing now.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show, Vicki. I was working in London. I'm from England originally. My boss said to me one day, I was wearing a career-limiting tie, and it was a tie with, you know, all the flags of the world on it, so maybe it wasn't the best choice. But he was really serious. He wasn't joking. And soon after that, we parted ways. But a year later, I ended up getting offered a job with the same company, but instead of in London, in Chicago. And it was kind of a choice, being unemployed, no work, or working for the same company back in Chicago. So I took a risk. And what was strange was it worked out really well. I was still the same person, but I won a couple of awards. I was making more money. And it really kind of came home to me when my new boss said, you know, I really like your socks, and they were bright red, not really very business-like. So it got me to thinking, you know, why was that so different? And then working over the last 10, 15 years with different people from around the world, finding that they had the similarities, that's what came to bring out the book.
So apart from the red socks that your boss liked, what was the difference for you in that particular job?
Well, in the first job, my boss wanted me to stuff envelopes, and I wanted to break out of the mold. You know, he wanted me to do administration and coordination. I wanted to be doing creative things. Mm. And then in Chicago, same job, but my boss actually wanted me to do different things and to do creative things. And so they wanted somebody with ideas, and they really longed for that. So sometimes it's, if you're in a job you really don't like, it can be that if you can find the right person in the same organization, you can have a job you really love, and you don't have to change yourself.
Do you know, and that's a very true point, because I work with people all over the world on various projects, and some of them might work for the same company, and I'm not talking about any company in particular, but, you know, major companies in general. And you can work with one group of people who are very relaxed and kicked back and have fun at work, and another group of people who are steeped in this hierarchy and don't have a great deal of fun, and yet they all work for the same company.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's really true. And I found that when I worked in Chicago, I was working on an international project to have people from all around the world, and they really like to work hard, but they really like to have fun. Whereas when I was in London, everybody was very serious, grey suits. You know, I was kind of the peacock amongst the pigeons.
Right, right. And yeah, I can relate to that. And I used to work in banking as well, which is the really grey area.
Yeah.
So you talk about outsiders as being oddballs, mavericks, whatever you want to call them. But what does it really mean not to fit in? What does it really mean to be an outsider?
Well, a lot of people are very miserable. You know, Friday night comes and they're dreading Monday morning already. Or some of them, you know, very successful, but just inside they're kind of being eaten away. And I see kind of five ways that people are different. Either they look different, so they could be of color, or they could be disabled, or, you know, something noticeable. They sound different. They have some kind of accent. Sometimes it's just that they do things differently. So, you know, they love to go traveling and backpacking, and all their buddies at work are staying at home during the vacation. Or they feel different, and that's one is, you know, you just don't feel like you fit in. When I first moved to Chicago, I was a, you know, British guy with Americans, and for a little while I felt kind of odd and felt, you know, an outsider. And then the last one is you're made to feel different, because I've coached a client who was, his name was Mohammed, and people made a lot of assumptions about what that meant, so they made him feel different because of that. So those five things usually lead you to being an outsider, but it can go different ways. You can feel, you can go different ways. You can be very successful, but inside it's not working out, or you can not be very successful because it's just too much for you.
Right. And I can remember when I first emigrated to San Diego from my hometown in England. And for the first couple of weeks, it was great. And then for the next few weeks, I kept hoping something would go wrong, so I'd have to go home. It's very tough. And you share a story in the book of having an accent, because people think we speak the same language. But when you first move, either Americans to England, or, you know, somebody from England to America, there's still a huge gap in the language there, isn't there?
There certainly is. Yeah, a couple of things happened. One, I would go into a restaurant and the waitress or the waiter would say, "Would you like soup or salad?" But I would hear, "Would you like a super salad?" So I would say, "Yes, I'd love a super salad." That sounds great. And they'd say, "No, would you like a soup or salad?" And, and then somebody American would have to kind of translate for me. No, it's a choice. It's not one thing.
Right.
Yeah, so it can be tough. And people who have lived here a long time sometimes have accents, and there's research which has shown that people will make assumptions. It's harder for you to get a job, and you have to kind of fight past that stereotype.
Very true, very true. A lot of it, especially with Brits, because we have a similar language, is intonation, I think. I had to learn to intonate differently because I kept getting into trouble for being too abrupt. And I thought I was just being efficient. But once we've accepted that this is not a situation that we fit in, you say we need to analyze what makes us different. Where do we start with that?
Well, it's good to look at what you like doing. So sometimes it's your hobbies, or it's the things that you do outside of work. It's the things that you did maybe as a kid. I had a client who was working for a company as a project manager, but she remembers as a kid building houses, so she retrained as an architect, because that's really what she loved doing. As a little kid, she built houses, and so as an adult, that's what she did. So it's kind of being a detective and seeing what are some of the things that you get a buzz out of, you get a kick out of, and then thinking, is there a way of turning that into money? Is there a way that somebody would buy that particular skill?
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to look at you share four outsider bridge building principles. So once we know we're an outsider, without compromising who we are, we want to learn to fit in so we can keep our job.
Yep.
So we're going to look at those four outsider bridge building principles. And I also have a couple of listener questions I'd like to run by you.
Great. Thank you.
My guest has written a great book. It's called Outsiders on the Inside, How to Create a Winning Career, Even When You Don't Fit In. He's David Cooper, career coach, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com. Monday, September 27th on Conversations Live. To find the mythical fountain of youth, you may need to look no further than your own body. Dermatologist Howard Murad talks to Vicky and debunks myths about hydration and inflammation and reveals the secrets of using water to help look and feel younger. Also, dream coach Joyce Chapman answers listener questions and provides a method to gain clarity over your challenges. Join us Monday at noon Pacific time for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is David Cooper. His new book is called Outsiders on the Inside, How to Create a Winning Career, Even When You Don't Fit In. And David is a coach. He works all over the world. I wanted to look here at four outsider bridge building principles. We know if we don't fit in. And this book is focused around work, but I think the principles still apply in maybe the social world, dating, in family situations. Would you agree, David?
Sure. I think it's very applicable, yeah.
Yeah. So let's look at the four outsider bridge building principles. And principle number one is, you say, let people know that you embrace your uniqueness. So instead of trying to hide it, embrace it. Talk a little about that, if you would.
Yeah, for sure. So as a Brit, I sometimes would get jokes about, you know, oh, you know, people doing fake accents. So I used to do an even more fake accent and just be like Dick Van Dyke or Mary Poppins and just kind of go for it. And I had a client who was Hispanic, a TV writer, and she went for it and marketed herself as the Hispanic female writer, and she got onto a couple of shows just because she wasn't trying to be like a lot of comedy writers, the white boy. She was trying to be Hispanic female, and that's how she marketed herself.
Yeah, that's a very good point. My mother used to live over here years ago, and she'd always say to people when they say, oh, you have an accent, she's like, no, I don't. You do. And I was actually walking my dog on the beach a few weeks ago, and I said to this guy, where are you from? Or where's your accent from? Because I knew he was English, but I couldn't tell from where, because, you know, we have thousands of different accents.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't have an accent. You do. And I said, no, I don't. I'm English, too.
Full circle.
Yeah, full circle. So embrace our uniqueness. And principle number two for bridge building, invite your coworkers to sample your worldview.
Right. So that's really kind of opening up about who you are. So I had I knew someone who it seemed like he had a problem with drinking. He was kind of wobbling around. He was not coherent. He actually had MS, so he needed to tell people that was what was going on. And it can be that, you know, if you're working with someone who's Jewish, that instead of, you know, pretending, and most people in the office are Christian, instead of pretending that you're just the same as everybody else, tell them about, you know, it's, you know, Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, tell them about what's happening. So sharing is a good way of breaking down some of those barriers.
Right. And what about if you're eccentric? you say principle number three, teach people about your eccentricity.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think about a lot of celebrities, you know, you have people who make it their trademark, you know, Carrot Top with his red hair, or you have Donald Trump with his weird hair. You know, that's right. Part of their eccentricity, or, you know, the Playboy guru who's wandering around in his pajamas the whole time. So sometimes it's, you know, build it up and actually tell people that's who you are.
And I noticed throughout your book, because you did say you like to entertain, you do talk about coming at this with an approach of fun and humor.
Yeah, definitely.
Bridge building principle number four, make your uniqueness your trademark.
Yeah, so I work with a great woman who was an engineer, not really a great engineer. She was working for a company, but she loved to do magic. She loved kind of fun things like that. And she realized there was a place in this engineering firm for her to become kind of an expert on problem solving and creativity. So the magic led into her doing kind of out-of-the-box type things. And what happened was she started to teach other people how to be creative. And when there were some layoffs, some of the moderate engineers got laid off, but she didn't, because she had made that uniqueness her trademark. She was the creativity person. She wasn't just that okay engineer anymore.
Right. Lot to be said for that. You talk about using all four personal brand strategies. You say we have four personal brand strategies.
Right.
How do we brand ourselves, and to make this, because we don't want to compromise who we are, but it is important, especially in today's economy, to learn to fit in, even if it's only during, you know, the work hours. So how do we brand ourselves and make use of those strategies?
So you're looking, if you think about beverages, for example, drinks. So water's free, or you can pay a lot of money for some kind of bottled water. And then you go up the food chain, I suppose, to think about, you know, what makes it expensive. So you have some kind of special malt whiskey, which is really expensive, or champagne. It's the same kind of thing with your brand. The more unique you are, the more scarce you are, the more people will pay for it. So when I moved to the U.S., one of the things which helped me with getting my green card and getting pretty good salary was I spoke Japanese. I'd lived in Japan. There were very few people who had that ability within my work environment.
Mm.
So doing something which makes one of your attributes, which is scarce, bring that to the forefront. Bring a new twist to something old. So think about, we've always done it this way. I worked in a training department where we threw out a whole bunch of videos, which people got bored with. We did something different. We did some satire. We did some fun. You can see that on YouTube. People doing something a little bit different with something which you've seen 100 times before. And then just look at who you are and create something as different as you are. I think like Ellen DeGeneres had a really rocky patch in her career when she came out.
Mm-hmm.
And now she has this great talk show. She's been hosting. She's won awards. Just kind of being herself and being this kind of nice person who just happens to be a lesbian. I mean, it's what you take and what you bring to the public. And then the fourth one is, you know, making sure that you can satisfy, if you're an employer or a customer. It's no good just being unique and not thinking about who might buy it. But if somebody has a specific need, then go out and try and sell that need. And think in terms of you're a product and you're selling yourself.
Yeah, makes sense. I want to ask you a question that came in from a listener here.
Sure.
This is a quite a common thing that I've seen. He says, I have a very stress and drama-free way of dealing with busy or stressful situations. I am always very good at being able to remain calm and keep a clear, focused head. Choosing to deal with the issues at hand rather than lose my cool and gripe about it. Problem is, people around him get very stressed and borderline hysterical, see him remaining calm, and that tweaks them even more. How do I combat this, i.e. they're freaking out, and remain even keeled and productive while people around me are having fits?
Yeah. Well, some people like drama. That's the problem. So I think it's maybe showing those people who are freaking out that he is committed, he is passionate about it. Maybe they're getting the impression that he's not. Mm. And it also may be finding the people who value that. There's probably people in his organization who value that. It may be a question of moving to somewhere where that calm is really a good thing. But it's a tough one. Some people like the drama, and it's a mistake to get drawn into it, I think.
They do, yeah. And I've actually been in this situation myself. When I think back, I remember when I was opening a new facility and a vice president swung by to see it before we were open and then made a comment to someone, "I'm really concerned about this because she," meaning me, "isn't stressed out enough."
Yeah.
But it's because everything was under control, dude.
Yeah. So sometimes, yeah, I think it's just showing that I'm not stressed out because it's under control. I'm really making that very concrete, so there isn't anything to worry. I'm still very committed. I'm still passionate, but I'm not freaking out because it's all under control.
Okay. Let me pick out another question here that might be relevant to what we're talking about now. How do I endear myself to my new colleagues? I'm normally a very outgoing, gregarious person, but find when I start a new job or have gone to a new school, I tend to clam up and don't really come out of my shell until I've adjusted to the people and personalities around me. Is there a good way to endear myself to my new colleagues? Am I hindering the process by being myself, my shy self?
Yeah, I think it's probably balancing. So if you're being shy and it's taking you 6 months to get to know people, probably a bad thing. But if you know, if it takes you a few weeks to warm up, that's probably not a bad thing. That's just who you are. I always think food kind of opens people up. So, you know.
Food?
Food.
Yes.
Cookies.
Did you hear my quick response then? Food.
Yeah. So, you know, by bringing in cookies, I think, or, you know, if you've got something that, you know, some family recipe you always make, you know, just making some, and that may be a way of kind of opening up the conversation. But I think some of it is, you know, just because you're quiet doesn't mean it's bad. So kind of go with that, and just it's okay to take a little time to warm up to people.
Right, right. So let's look at tools to sell ourselves. You have a whole chapter dedicated to tools. When you're working with people in this kind of situation, what's one of the first things you'll tell them to use as a tool, David?
To sell themselves?
Yes.
Yeah. So it just depends what.
I know it's going to vary on what kind of situation we're in, really, but give us a high-level view of a couple of tools that you might recommend.
Yeah, so I think if you're looking for a new job, people go with resumes and things like that. I think a better tool, because a resume ends up on a desk, you know, hundreds of them, you don't really, it's hard to stand out. A better tool is to get a pitch going for yourself and having stories that you can tell people about what you do in work or what you do outside of work. So that can really work well. I worked with a client who one day he came to visit me for a session. He had this great bicycle, really expensive one. I started talking to him about that, and he does extreme cycling, and he also raises a whole bunch of money for races and sponsorship for charity. And he was looking to move out from his very boring kind of project manager job to move into something more creative. So I said, you should be talking about how you've raised, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for charity, because that's a great thing for an ad agency where he wanted to move into and doing business development. Mm-hmm. So he created a nice little story about, you know, how he, the last race he'd done and how he got money from different people and celebrities, and it really worked out for him. It's just a quick, short, interesting story which led into how he would be great for this job.
Yeah. And you talk about social networking. How do you find that works for people looking for work?
Well, if it's not something you can do quickly, but I had a client who he was out of work. He tweeted, you know, looking for something. Within 20 minutes, he had 3 leads.
Wow.
But yeah, it's pretty amazing.
But he must have had the right followers, right?
Yeah, that's right. But what he'd been doing beforehand was that he'd been setting himself up as an expert. So he's in the entertainment business, and he, every time he saw an article, he would just link to that and Twitter about it. And so that he really positioned himself as someone who knows what's going on. And I think when you have a job, you should be doing that kind of thing to show whatever you whatever field you're in, you're an expert on that, and this is useful information. And then people remember that, and then you can build on that relationship and ask for leads or contacts if you want a new job.
Mm. Now, one of the things you talk about is intention in the book, and it's something we've talked about before. It's something I think some people just kind of grasp onto like a straw almost. I am thinking of somebody I know who always says, oh, well, my intention's to do this. Just put it out there and it's going to happen. But there's a little bit more to it than that, right?
Yeah, it would be nice if it was as easy as that.
I wish.
I think intention is really important. And I think I've had a client who she was, for her particular job, when she was looking for a new one, she was asking, I think, about 50% more than the market was really going to pay. And we had this kind of tough conversation. I said, you're not going to make that money. I think that's really too much. But she had an intention. That's what she was going to do. So that's what kind of happened. And I think if you can set your intention, so writing it down, being very clear about it, visualizing it, living it, breathing it, and then making sure there are no kind of old stories or chatter going on which will prevent you from living that intention, there's no reason why it can't happen. I think most people get kind of tripped up with, you know, they think, you know, my intention is to, you know, make $10,000 more. Mm-hmm. And then they start thinking, well, I'm not really worth $10,000. I'm worth maybe $8,000 or, you know, $5,000 on a good day. You know, and they kind of talk themselves out of their intention a lot of times.
Yeah.
So I think it's really being very focused and saying to the voices, you know, thanks for that information, but right now I'm focused on getting where I want to get.
Mm, makes sense. Now, when outsiders feel different, as they do, I mean, I'm sure we've all been in situations, whether it's a work situation or a social situation, even a family situation, where we just feel like we're on the outside looking in at this goldfish bowl.
Yeah.
When we're feeling that, what are some coping strategies that we can use?
Well, yeah, I mean, especially the family situation, it can be tough. But I think going back to your question about the drama, you know, you don't have to get involved with it. Some people like the drama in families. It's the same thing. Trying to think that a lot of things which are said are not necessarily personal. They're really about the person who's saying it rather than about you. And just being able to kind of step back and look at that person and think, okay, that person is upset. I could make it because, you know, upset about me, or I could make it just because they're upset.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of deal with it that separate way. It's a tough one. Families, Thanksgiving is coming up, so get prepared.
That's a whole other show.
Yeah, that's right.
You say even successful outsiders must live in the present, but remember the past. Tell us what you mean by that.
So I think I have an example in the book about New Coke. So Coca-Cola came up with this New Coke,
mm-hmm.
and I think they just didn't remember that, you know, Coca-Cola had been around for years. People loved it. So why make something different? It just didn't make sense to change the recipe, and it was a big failure. And even the head honchos said that. Now, what was a good idea was things like, you know, Coke with lime or, you know, a flavoring in Coke, because people were already doing that, make it more convenient.
Right.
So if you come up with something so new that, and you've kind of ignored the past, it's really a problem. So if you come up with a way of having a new computer system and you forget that people like touching pieces of paper and you ban paper, it's not going to work. We can see that, you know, how many people print out emails. They still want that comfort of the paper from the past.
Yeah, I do that sometimes.
Yeah, me too. I'm guilty.
I must admit. We have to let you go soon, but you say successful outsiders don't avoid the world. And I know when people do feel that they're outside, that there's a tendency for them to want to hide away, whether that's in their own office or, you say in the book, some people hide out in knowledge. Mm-hmm. What should they be doing?
Well, it's if you have something really unique you're trying to sell, you can hide out a little bit, I guess. And people, are experts on the internet and don't meet people, that's okay. But what I do see is someone who has a great hobby making this fun jewelry, but she never shows anybody. She doesn't want to get rejected. She doesn't show anybody. She never sells any. So she keeps on with the job she hates, whereas this kind of pastime she loves, which could be a money-making deal, but she kind of hides out in her fear, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people who, I know someone who's very smart. He's an expert on philosophy, but you don't understand 90% of what he's saying. So it's kind of hard to get along with him.
Right.
He's just kind of hiding out in his knowledge, and that's another fear thing. He doesn't want to be confronted, I guess, and not know something.
Right. So we have to get over that. Well, interesting book, David.
Thank you.
You have a whole chapter at the end of the book, which is a plan on putting this all together. Very useful for somebody who's going through this kind of situation now, or even has been in that situation. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I do have a plan how you can either find a new job or change your career. And there's also plan sometimes kind of scares people, but there's also like creative ways of doing it, everything from writing poetry to acting out a play. So it doesn't have to be a kind of an action plan with tasks and things. And if you want more information, I have a lot of tips on resumes and interviewing on my website, which is davidcoopercoach.com. and as Vicky said, Cooper is spelled COOPER, so it's davidcoopercoach.com. And there's a lot of free stuff there. I love to hear from people. And if you have questions, let me know.
Super. Thank you so much for being with us today. My guest again, David Cooper, his book, Outsiders on the Inside, How to Create a Winning Career Even When You Don't Fit In. Please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by Peter Miller, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Expand your loving heart at the One Gathering 4, October 3rd, 4 to 6:30 p.m. at the Theater off Jackson in downtown Seattle. I'm Jennifer Yost, creator of the One Gathering. Join me and my special guests, Narian and Janet Baltzo, Paul Chokotin Wagner, author speaker Carol Haywood, and Vijay Tassara at this multi-sensory program intended to lift our consciousness. Visit theonegathering.com for details and to buy tickets.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Some people know a good thing when they hear it. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Peter Miller. He's the author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making and Getting Things Done. Peter's the senior editor at National Geographic. He's served as a writer and editor at the magazine for more than 25 years. I suspect that's a job that many people envy Peter. Peter Miller, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Vicki.
This is such an interesting book. Oh my gosh. I was reading this and thinking, oh my goodness, you just don't realize what's going on behind things that we see and take for granted every day. But before we dive into this, let's just take a little bit. You've worked for National Geographic, as I said, for 25 years. You've studied this topic, I understand, the smart swarm, for a long, long time. Tell us what the smart swarm means. It's a bit of a tongue twister there. And how you got interested in it.
Well, what I'm talking about are essentially colonies of ants, hives of bees, herds of animals, flocks of birds, schools of fish, any group that solves problems better as a group than the individuals can, so that the individual ants or bees become smarter or safer or stronger because they act as a group.
Now, one of the examples I gave at the top hour of the show was that Southwest Airlines used ants to determine the most efficient way to board a plane. Share that story with us, if you would. It seems really hard to believe, but having stood in line, I can believe it.
Well, Southwest, has for a long time allowed passengers to pick their own seat, which is very unusual in the airline business. Usually you get a pre-reserved seat. They were getting a little bit of feedback from their business customers that it would be nice. Business customers would like to be treated a little better and maybe not have to get in line. So they asked one of their analysts to figure out what would be the impact of switching over from their anything goes, pick your own seat, to having reserve seats. And he looked at the problem and said, wait a minute, a lot of individuals cramming into a tight space trying to optimize their decision-making, this is a biological problem. This is just like the ants. He'd been studying ant systems because, as a programmer, there are certain algorithms that have developed from biologists studying ant colonies that have been used in computer simulations. So what he did was, he developed a program that treated the passengers as if they were ants. In other words, the ants would be ants only have a few rules that they follow in nature. They're very simple creatures, and so he gave these computer programs very simple options. So he had the ants board the plane, and they would kind of jam together in the galley, and they would get to the seating area, and then depending on the little information that he programmed, they would try and find a seat. And he ran the simulation thousands and thousands of times using different patterns, boarding from the back, boarding from the windows to the aisles, all the different patterns that airlines use. And he found out that, yes, he could save a few minutes if they boarded in a certain way, but the airline, the top executive, decided that it wasn't worth it to change their image from being kind of the freewheeling, fun-loving airline. Right. So they decided to do a different system.
Interesting. Now, Martin Cruz Smith is an author, the author of Gorky Park, said that in your book, you've proven that there is intelligent life on Earth, but it's not necessarily us.
Right, right.
You have a lot of stories in the book. You share stories, which I hope we'll get time for, but do you have a particular favorite story?
I love the bees. I really love the honeybees because there's certain behavior that I study that I write about the way that they make decisions as a group. And I know if you're like me, and you get a group of friends together and you try and decide where to go to a movie or a theater or dinner, and it's hard to get agreement or consensus. And the bees have evolved a system whereby 10,000 bees can make a decision, a timely decision, under pressure and in a very reliably accurate fashion. And I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring, a beehive needs to find a new home because it outgrows the one that it's in. So half the bees will leave with the queen, and they'll need to find someplace, a good spot, a hollow in a tree, say, in the neighborhood where they can go and live. But for a period of time, they don't know where the best spot is. So they hang on a tree. Maybe you've seen them in Seattle. And
right.
A swarm of them. And it's kind of scary to see with
yeah,
so many bees.
Yeah, it's very,
you know,
very scary. Yeah, very scary when you see that.
But what they do is they send out hundreds of scout bees into the neighborhood to check out every possible location. And the bees come back to the swarm and they report. They report on what they found by doing a little waggle dance. A waggle dance is a physical dance. I mean, they do a little circle, figure eight dance, and the dance tells the other bees where they've been and what they've seen and what the quality of the sight is that they've seen, so that the bees that are watching the little waggle dance, if they get excited and interested, they can go check out the same site and then come back and either dance for it or not. So what you get going is a little dance contest whereby the bees try and build up support. Each sort of faction tries to build up support for the site that they visited. And when the bees, the support reaches a certain threshold, then the bees have made the decision and they go to that site. So you say, okay, what does that have to do with me? Well, it has to do with decision-making in all natures. I mean, corporations or church groups or even in your own decision-making. The bees gather all the information they can. They get as many different options as they can. They allow the ideas to compete with one another in a kind of free-for-all to see which one is the best. And then they have a specific mechanism for choosing it, sort of like voting, that under time pressure allows them to make decisions in a timely fashion. And the scientists have found out that they are almost always correct. They almost always pick the best site.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, I understood that wasps were hierarchical. Is that true, or are they the same as bees?
Wasps are solitary. I don't know much about wasps, to tell you the truth.
Right.
I believe there are some social wasps, but bees are completely social.
Well,
in other words, they exist only as a group, and that the behavior of each individual is tuned to serve the group rather than their own personal interests.
Isn't that interesting? I'm never going to look at them the same way. And I love that you said they allow ideas to compete, which so often we don't when we're working in so-called teams in corporations.
Yeah, that's one of our problems, is that we tend to let too much social pressure, peer pressure, or other kinds of, you know, hierarchical, like the boss is in the room, so you don't want to speak up.
Right, right.
Interfere with getting the best ideas out on the table and hashing it out.
Right. I want to talk a little bit more about peer pressure. We need to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back. My guest is Peter Miller. He's the senior editor at National Geographic, and he's written a really, truly interesting book called The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
I was carried to Ohio in a swarm of bees.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I was carried to Ohio in a swarm of bees.
And welcome back. I don't know where Eric finds this music from. I was carried to Ohio in a swarm of bees. And very appropriate, because we're talking with Peter Miller. He's the senior editor at National Geographic, and we were just sharing his favorite story of bees. And Peter spent years investigating what the collective intelligence of swarms, flocks, herds, and schools can teach us about our own networks and our systems and our business hierarchies. And Peter, I wanted to, first of all, how long did it take you to put this together? Because there's a lot of research in this book.
Well, I wrote an article for National Geographic that appeared in 2007. And then I spent another year and a half re-interviewing and digging deeper into the research behind the biology.
Yeah, and it's written beautifully, as one would expect of a National Geographic writer. I mentioned at the top of the hour the story of the CIA and how they use termites to create more effective spy networks. So tell us about that.
What's the connection between termites and the CIA? The termites, like ants and bees, do amazing things when they get giant numbers together. In a termite colony in Africa, you might have 2 million individuals. And one of the most astonishing things they do is create these mounds, these structures, that can be 10 feet tall and can have this elaborate architecture that you can't imagine how a tiny insect could have conceived. And the way that they build it is through indirect collaboration. In other words, one termite will make one little change, and then other termites will come along and see that change and make other little changes. And they tweak things infinitely until the entire mound is created. None of them understands really what the big picture is, but each one makes little tweaks.
Mm-hmm.
So this came to the attention of a CIA analyst named Calvin Andrus, who was thinking about all of the information after 9/11 that was siloed in the different 16 different intelligence agencies. And what he was saying was, we need a way of collaborating. We need a way of sharing information, getting information out in front of each other so that before it's sort of finished and we understand it, so that the analyst could say, here's what I know, what do you know, what do you make of all this information? They needed to have a platform where they could sort of be like the termites and tweak each other's intelligence or data or findings. So they created something called Intellipedia, which is the spy's version of Wikipedia. And on it, they when something happens, they can create a page just like anybody can create a page on Wikipedia, and which is the online encyclopedia that we all know and love.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been going for a couple of years now, and they've built out the this platform to include, in addition to Intellipedia, other things that sort of resemble Flickr or Facebook or blogs. And it's been a pretty interesting experiment for the agents. And what they've told me is that as a sort of demonstration project, it's shown that there's a lot to be gained from collaborating in real time rather than waiting for everything to be all buttoned up. But it's still not going to replace the that habits and the way that intelligence is finally processed at the intelligence agencies.
Now, who comes up with these ideas in the first place? I just imagine somebody sitting there. How does it begin?
Well, you know, Calvin Andrus had been reading about the work of a biologist, Deborah Gordon, at Stanford, who is the scientist that I followed with the ants. And he realized that groups in nature have a way of communicating with one another and sharing information that's difficult for us to do because we're not like them. We're not designed sort of from the bottom up to be to serve the collective. We're individuals, and we find it hard to be that devoted to the group. Mm. But because of the way that colonies of insects have evolved, they have these ways of collaborating. And so what he was saying was that the intelligence agencies maybe could learn a little bit from some of those habits of the insects.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating, and there's such a lot of truth in it. You share a story in the book about peer pressure, and I wonder if you'd share the story. You gave an example of the guy, the candid camera skit, for example, in the elevator. What can we learn from these studies in peer pressure?
Well, the candid camera, I don't know if your listeners will remember this because it was a few years ago, but I'm sure they'll get the idea. This poor fellow, he's being secretly filmed, and he's the mark. He goes into an elevator, and then everybody else that comes in the elevator are part of the candid camera crew, and on a signal from one of them, they all turn and face the rear of the elevator. And here he is, on the elevator, and everybody is turned around. And you just watch him. His brain is in agony. He finally slowly turns around and faces the rear of the elevator for no reason at all, except that all the others have done this. And they relentlessly torture this guy. They turn to the right. They turn to the left. They put their hats on. They take their hats off. And he's following all of this behavior, completely unaware that he's being, filmed. And what it is a great demonstration of our instinct to kind of follow the herd if we're uncertain. When we don't really know what's going on, our instincts tell us, well, do what everybody else is doing.
Right.
And that can be very smart in some situations, like when you're driving down the road and you see all the taillights turn red.
Yes, yeah.
That's a good indication that you should hit your brakes, or at least think about hitting your brakes. But if you're an investor in the stock market, or you're in a company and you're trying to come up with something original, maybe following the herd blindly without considering the fundamentals of the stock that you're thinking about buying, or about the nature of the ideas that the product you're proposing for your company, maybe being part of the herd is not what you should be doing.
Yeah, you actually say in there that's how some people get standing ovations is simple peer pressure.
Oh yeah, standing ovations are a wonderful example of our tendencies, to do what everybody else is doing, and at the same time we have our own feelings. Did we enjoy the performance or not? We'd like to express those, but if we're one of the ones who maybe didn't enjoy it, and everybody's standing up, there's kind of a you really feel uncomfortable if the only one sitting and everybody else is giving a standing ovation.
Mm, it's true. What surprised you the most when you were doing your studies here? We've only got about a minute or so left, Peter.
Well, I guess it was about how by simply paying attention to one another, we can pick up information and make ourselves smarter. And also how we can work on remembering some of these techniques to kind of counteract the bad habits that we have. I really wasn't quite aware of that. Psychologists have done a lot of work now on sort of the decision making flaws that we have, and that by paying attention to the group's instincts, we can also counteract some of those individual flaws that we have.
Well, it absolutely does make for a truly fascinating read, and I encourage people who are interested in this topic to check it out. It's beautifully written as well. Website, Peter, where people can find out more information. I'm looking at it, but go ahead.
The Smart Swarm.
The Smart smartswarm.com. And the book, again, is called The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. And my guest, of course, National Geographic Senior Editor, Peter Miller. Thanks, Peter, for being with us today.
You're quite welcome. Thanks, Vicky.
And thank you for tuning in today. We'll be back next week with an all-new live show. Until then, live well, live strong, and you can check me out at conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Thanks for spending this hour with us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.